Billiards, an authorized Brunswick dealer specializing in pool tables, custom cues, and game room furniture. Funds for this day of broadcasting come in part from a contribution by Dorothy Newman in memory of her mother, Marjorie Chadwick Reese.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. I'm glad to have you with us. The producers for this show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal and Henry Frayne is at the controls. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you here with us this morning. This is the second hour of the program, and in this hour, we will be bringing you a story of what it is like to live off the grid. Now, I suppose to different people, that phrase might mean something different. In this hour, we'll talk with a guy who's written a book about his experiences doing this in a fairly dramatic way. His name is Eric Brendy, and he and his wife spent almost a year living in the country with an old order Anabaptist group, and they gave up, substantially gave up, all of the modern conveniences of life, like electric lights and stove and refrigerator and running water and just about everything else that was motorized. And among the things that they found was that by getting rid of a lot of that technology that we might consider essential, life became more healthy and less stressful. And he's written about these experiences in a book which he titles Better Off, Flipping the Switch on Technology. And it's now available in a paperback edition published by Harper Perennial. Now he and his family live in St. Louis, where he makes his living as a rickshaw driver and a soap maker. And if you're interested, by the way, in finding out about his rickshaw service, and you can go to, and you're interested in going to St. Louis and getting around that way, you can go to the website, which is www.stlouisrickshaw, and I guess that's, I should say, it's abbreviated ST, stlouisrickshaw.com, and you can find out about that. And of course, if you'd like to read the book, Better Off, you can head out to the bookstore and look for it. Questions, of course, here on the program are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Mr. Brendy, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
I'm happy to be here.
We certainly appreciate you giving us some of your time. I think that certainly what you learned by taking a look at the book is that before you decided on this experiment in living, you would not necessarily, particularly, I guess if you look at the kind of person you were earlier in your life, you would not necessarily have considered yourself anti-technology. In fact, when you decided to do this, you and your wife, just married, you had been doing graduate work at MIT.
Right. And, well, by the time I got to MIT, I was already a little bit or very strongly skeptical of the direction the technology was going, however. But earlier in my teens, I was an ardent fan of all the latest gadgetry. I loved reading Isaac Asimov science fiction novels. I loved sitting around the house watching Star Trek on TV. And I liked nothing more than the idea of someday in the future, people being able to ride around in the sky in their little spaceships just the way they did it on the Jetsons and things like that. But gradually, as I grew older, some of the experiences I had in my later teenage years began to cast doubt on the whole wonderful utopian technological future.
Was there anything in particular, or maybe there were some things in particular, that got you to the point where you were really thinking about, I think it's not necessarily that you were rejecting technology out of hand, but that certainly you were asking questions about the impact that technology has on our lives, in particular this question about what machines we might want to use, what we might not, how it is we use them. So the kind of things that probably a lot of people really don't think very much at all about at all.
Well, I remember the time my dad went out and got one of the first word processors ever made, and of course this dates me a little bit. And the idea of the word processor was, of course, to save time and the time and trouble of writing and make it go a lot faster and easier. Well, my dad spent so much time with that device, I almost never saw him again. And I think the seed of the idea was planted in my head, perhaps, that maybe these time-saving devices don't so much save us time as gobble up all of our time. I also remember a conversation I had casually with one of my fellow employees at McDonald's when I was 15 going on 16, and I simply asked him, "Oh, so why did you decide to work at McDonald's?" And he says, "Well, I wanted to save up some money for a car." And I said, "Oh, so why did you want to get a car?" And he says, "How else can I get to work?"
Kind of circular reasoning, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think in so much of our technology today, we're going in a circle. We're on a treadmill. We do indeed spend something like 25% of a working year just devoted to either to the direct cost of transportation or to actually sitting in an automobile or some other form of transportation. So the idea that these modern devices actually save us time driving to work, they've actually expanded the amount of time we spend either in a car or for the sake of a car.
Mm-hmm. Well, the story, it's beginning, or that you're spending this time living this way, begins where you're actually on a trip. You're going from MIT back to Kansas, where you grew up, and you decided to hop the dog, so you were on the bus, and you met a man and struck up a conversation with him, and that's kind of how it started. Maybe you could tell the story of that meeting.
Yeah, well, the funny thing is about taking the bus was that at the time there was an airfare war going on, so I could have flown back to Kansas City for the same price, but I gritted my teeth because I wanted to walk the talk and really experience the transition from the East Coast to the Midwest instead of just popping suddenly into Kansas City, which I never really liked to do anyway. So I took this trip as part of my beginning to experiment with less technology. And sure, and I got more than I bargained for, because on the bus walked a man at Pittsburgh with a big wide-brim black hat on and solid black colored clothing. And I assumed that he was Amish from his dress. Well, he was from, not really Amish, he was, I struck up a conversation and found out he was from a very unusual group that was related to the Amish, but the difference was that they were stricter technologically than the Amish. Most Amish draw the line at motor vehicles and electricity, but the group that this man was from went further. They also cut out all motorized devices. That meant they didn't use any chainsaws, any stationary farming equipment, any motorized pumps. And all of these devices are very common. They're gasoline-powered engines or propane-powered devices in Amish communities. If you go to a typical Amish barn raising, for example, it's very noisy because of all the motorized devices they use, especially the chainsaws. But here in this community, they did everything by hand or by horsepower. So from the point of view of most Amish, this group was as far back in the past as most Amish are from our point of view. So it was quite an adventure that was that I stumbled onto by meeting this man on the bus. I got to know him briefly. He seemed to sympathize with my whole area of interest, and I was able to set up a year-and-a-half stay in his community thanks to his help.
Mm-hmm. I would guess that there probably are some number of people, maybe not a big number, but some number who would think this was interesting to try, some who would just like to try living that life. I'm sure that there probably are many people who have thought, wouldn't that be a great master's thesis or a PhD, and probably have actually done that sort of thing. Journalists who wanted to go and write books, and some such books have been written. But I would guess that communities like this would be a little cautious about who it is that they would like to have living among them, and to try to figure out, well, what is exactly this person about? What are they interested in? What's their motivation? Not all communities, and I really don't know how many there would be, but not all communities like that would be particularly welcoming to outsiders.
Well, precisely, and that's why I agreed before going to live with them that if I wrote anything about them, I would not disclose their identities or their location. So that put them at their ease, and it made it possible for us to have a very natural kind of stay with them where they didn't feel like they were under the microscope.
Yeah. And indeed, you don't, in the book, Better Off, you don't say where it is.
No, I don't.
How many people live in this community?
About 80 families. Hmm. At the time that we were there, it probably has grown since then, but...
I guess one of the things that I think is interesting about it is that it seems that a fair number of people who live in this community were not born into it, but that they chose it or decided that that was the way that they would want to live, and that they might have come from communities where life was similar but not perhaps quite so strict in a sense. And I don't mean to imply anything judgmental by using the term strict. For example, some of the people that you met actually had come from, say, other communities, perhaps Mennonite communities. I don't know, there was one person in particular who had been a Mennonite, but come from a community where they had lived with more modern technology, where they had cars and they had telephones, who had actually made the decision that they wanted to simplify their life and had come here and had chosen to live like this.
Yes, and that was one of the remarkable things about the community, that even though it was very strict technologically, it was very open to having outsiders come in and either join or live on the fringe, as we did. And the people who constituted the core of the group were often very thoughtful, and they didn't see their way of life as simply a kind of a select club for those who had been raised Amish, as a lot of Amish groups seem to be. A lot of Amish groups are almost hostile to the idea of outsiders coming in. They're very leery, partly because it hasn't worked very well when outsiders have tried to join. But this group had a different attitude, and I think that's because they saw themselves as going back to the real basics of their particular religious denomination founded by Menno. Menno Simon was the original Mennonite, and the Amish are actually an offshoot of the Mennonites. And this group saw itself as kind of a back-to-the-basics Mennonite group.
We have a caller here. Would welcome others. Maybe I should introduce our guest again for anybody who might have tuned in. We're talking with Eric Brendy. He tells the story of this year that he spent in this community in his book, Better Off, Flipping the Switch on Technology. It's available in paperback now, published by Harper Perennial. He now makes his home in St. Louis, he and his family. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And we have a couple of callers here. Someone to start us off listening in Indiana. So we'll go there first on the toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I live in an area of northern Indiana, basically north central, it's usually called. And we have German Baptists and other groups. And I know from my experience as a child that if you get them confused, you'll be straightened out very quickly wherever you might be, which I always thought was sort of strange with a group that presumably was... you know, Mother Earth and all that kind of stuff. I've never been able to get anybody, or I've never experienced anyone saying why the choice is to give up these things. Is there some kind of biblical precedent here, or are they reaching into the Bible and saying this and that? Is exactly what it is that they, make that choice? I mean, I went through that stage in the 60s. When I lived out in a woods and stuff, and then I finally decided that if I ever got ill, I really would like to have some penicillin or something like that to keep myself alive. So I'm sort of concerned about the philosophical position here, and in a sense, it's pretty easy to do that in this country if you think about it, because it just take a step sideways, and all of a sudden you can have some medicines. And I was always I remember once as a child. Seeing a man pull up in what was the horse and the wagon, and got out, and I just happened to be close to him in the store, and I learned that the watch he had was a Rolex, and somehow the there's a crack there somewhere, and so I have you know, since those early days when you were looking around what you're going to do, I decided that, no, I never wanted to do this kind of stuff. But I was wondering about, do they cite biblical passages or something? Or exactly how did this choice start? You talk about back to the basics. Well, you know, somebody's basics is somebody else's not basics. And I was wondering if you could stretch that out a little bit. Thanks.
Okay. Well, can you do that?
Well, sure. Menno Simon was actually a Catholic priest who left the Catholic Church in the early 1500s, I believe, because he saw the Catholic Church at the time as becoming rather decadent and caught up in worldly matters, and he wanted to return to what he viewed, what he saw as a simpler, more personal form of Christianity. And one of the key elements of that for the Mennonites is adult baptism or believer's baptism, where the adult makes a conscious choice to become Christian and then is baptized instead of being baptized as an infant when they don't know what is happening. And they thought that that had a lot to do with what they saw as the drift in Christianity, where people were Christian and they didn't know why. So every person in one of these communities has made the conscious decision when they're older. And some of them, they go off on a Herumspringa, which is called a running around period in their teens to get all their wild stuff out of their system. And then many, the majority, do come back and formally make the decision to join and be baptized. And as for why technology is such an important issue in these communities, there's one more element that makes them perhaps different from other, especially Protestant groups, and that is, for them, salvation is not just a personal or an individual matter. It's an interpersonal matter. It's one that involves the whole community, where you are partly responsible for the eternal well-being, not only yourself, but those around you. So they see everything in terms of how it affects not only the individual, but also the whole community. And before modern technology was very advanced, it was not a big issue for them. But once modern technology became more sophisticated and the automobile arrived and the telephone, these groups questioned very seriously the impact of those devices on their community life, and I think they, quite rightly so, they saw that the automobile tended to fragment community and make it more anonymous. You didn't interact as much directly with your neighbor, and you were driving around all over the place. And the telephone they saw as another way of reducing face-to-face interaction. So it also diluted the quality of community and also encouraged anonymous gossip, which they did not approve of. These kinds of discussions were held in Amish and other kinds of Old Order Anabaptist communities, and they still are to this day. The group where we lived was especially thoughtful, I believe, in making their technological choices. They had council meetings on a regular basis in which they discussed issues like the effect of the telephone. Although they didn't allow telephones in their homes or even on their properties, they were allowed to use pay phones or sometimes borrow neighbors' phones, and sometimes they would pay the neighbor to use the phone during emergency situations or maybe to set up sales for grocery stores. They sell large quantities of produce to grocery stores, and the only way to get a hold of the grocery stores in time was to phone them. But they had discussions about this and the impact on their community life, and they were very concerned that these kinds of practices could go overboard. And I talk about that in the book. So I don't know if that fully answers the gentleman's question, but I think that the basic underlying difference here between Amish and Old Order Mennonite groups and the rest of Protestant America is that these groups really see the community as being central, playing a central role in the personal spiritual life of each individual.
Hmm. And I think it's probably good to make the point that there may be different groups who may approach this differently, that to an outsider might all look the same, and yet there may be significant differences from one group of people to another, but maybe the one thing that they share in common is that a very kind of deliberate, thoughtful approach to technology to decide which they're going to use and which they're not. And in some cases, as you say, for example, like with the telephone, it's not a total rejection, but they're keeping it, in a sense, they're keeping it at its place because they're concerned with what a widespread adoption of it, if everyone had one in their house, what that would mean.
Right. And I wouldn't say that all Amish communities are equally thoughtful in their examination of technology. I think that some of them have problems in this area. Some of them, as the caller pointed out, there are some people who see the rules about technology as just that, rules that need to be obeyed. But if there are loopholes, if we can buy a Rolex watch, that's okay because it's not mentioned in the rules. And those groups tend to be more vulnerable to outside influence because they lose sight of the overarching reasons for why they have the rules. But generally speaking, in these Amish communities, there is this deeper understanding of the role of community as being the underlying reason.
Well, maybe let me ask you at this point, and I have a caller I want to get to. I want to promise that person I won't make them wait forever. But let me ask you the question. You did this as an experiment, you and your wife, for a year. And now, as I've mentioned a couple of times, you live in St. Louis. Why did you decide to leave? Did it ever cross your mind that you might like permanently to be a member of this community?
Well, we were very interested in the possibility of staying in the area of the community. We were not interested in formally joining and formally becoming members, and this is one of the tensions that is in the book all throughout, because we ourselves are Catholic, and the group had its roots in a rejection of Catholicism. And I suppose if I lived in that day and age when Catholicism had gotten away from the basics and when it had was caught up more in building a huge church in St. Peter in Rome named St. Peter's, and everyone was being taxed for that, and they were all interested in the marble statues, I can see how it would have been very tempting to want to join a group like that. Today, I think the Catholic Church has kind of come back to its senses and has gotten away from that worldly political involvement that it used to be so dominant. So for us, we saw less of a need to actually abandon our own heritage. So that's why we weren't thinking of staying on as formal members. We were very interested in staying on as informal associates of the community, and we also thought that it would be a wonderful way of life for people from all faiths, including Catholics. And the reason why we ultimately decided not to stay in the community has to do with some curious developments in the plot of the book, which I don't want to reveal because I don't want to give away too much. It is a story, and there are some suspenseful elements. I narrate it as a story, as a first-person narrative, and I'd rather not give away too much.
All right, that's fair enough. Well, in that case, let me just introduce again very quickly our guest, Eric Brendy. The book, if you'd like to read about his experiences, is titled Better Off, Flipping the Switch on Technology, and it's published by Harper Perennial, available in a paperback essay about this year experience that he and his wife, living in a community, an old order Anabaptist community, and they gave up a lot of modern technology to see what that would be like, and read about it in the book. Now they make their home in St. Louis. Questions, of course, are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. We have another caller here, a couple of callers, someone in Atlanta, Illinois. We'll go there. Line number two. Hello.
Good morning. I've got a question for you that might be a little bit interesting. A couple of weeks ago on the afternoon talk show on this program, the lady interviewed a person that had written a book called The Long Emergency, and this dealt with the economy of running out of oil here in this century. And his ideas of what would happen is that we would all have to revert back to a life similar to the Amish-type life today. And what I would like to know, since you've lived that kind of life and you know the ins and outs of it, particularly the emotions, the doing withouts, and all those things. What percentage of Americans do you think could survive going back to that kind of a lifestyle?
I think a lot more than can survive our current modern technological lifestyle, because for a number of reasons, I think that the idea that modern technology makes life easier and more convenient is an illusion. I think we've gone way past the point when technology is making our lives easier. I think it's definitely making them more difficult. And you can look at it either at the personal level of your own experience and just think about how you spend your time during the day and how much time you really have left over for the things that matter, or you can look at it maybe even statistically. Now we spend statistically 2 hours a day in an automobile, 3 hours a day in front of a computer, 4 hours a day in front of a television set. And all of these devices are time eaters. They can be very expensive to maintain and run, and thereby require a lot more time and effort and work on our part, such as especially the automobile. And in the meantime, we are sitting there at this device making relatively inefficient use of our time. The automobile is a totally... The automobile, television, and computer are very passive devices where you simply sit immobile operating a set of controls. You're largely cut off from social contact from other people, from the outdoors, or from any kind of deeper, meaningful, substantial experience of life. And then people wonder why at the end of the day there's not enough time. Well, they've gotten too much wrapped up in the technology itself that was supposed to save them time. So I think that if people went back to a life similar to the Amish, they would discover it to be liberating. And I don't know how many people have told me stories about how when the lights went out, the electricity went out for a couple of days in New York or whatever, they found it liberating. They were suddenly talking with their neighbors that they never met before, or their office workers, and making new ties and friendships and using their own limbs to get around instead of relying on the automobile. And it was a liberating experience. And this, to an extent, extends to health. You asked how we could survive. I think that the majority of health problems today that we're paying so much money for, I don't know what it is, 15% of the gross national product, we're paying, you know, $700 a month insurance premiums. And what are we paying for? We're paying for the negative health consequences of a stressful, sedentary way of life. We sit around all the time. We don't get enough exercise. We eat too many processed foods. And as a result, we have a whole host of ailments that are very expensive to cure, and they're chronic, and they weigh us down. So I think that's another big irony, that I think we will be better off if we get fresh air, exercise, and in the process of carrying out our daily errands.
I sure like what you had to say, and I couldn't agree with you more, and thank you very much for the comments.
Oh, sure.
Well, let's talk again with someone else. The next caller is in Forest, Illinois. This is on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi, my name is Donald Schultz. I was listening to this very interesting program, as it always is, but I had one comment. It seems a contradiction of terms to have this sort of lifestyle and have a website. It just seems kind of strange. It reminded me of being in Arthur, Illinois, a year or two ago, and saw a team of horses pulling a cultivator of sorts, and it had a diesel engine on the cultivator. It seems sort of an interesting contradiction. I would say this about the Internet. I know a lot of us have a sedentary life using the Internet, but there is so much learning that can take place there, and deep learning. And it seems to me it's a matter of how we use things, probably more than anything else. Thanks a lot.
Well, I thank you for the comment. Sure. You want to, Eric? You want to talk about? You want to talk about the website or anything else that has to do with how it is that. And obviously, you've made some modifications now. You and your family are living in St. Louis, and you're not living in the way that you lived when you were living in this community that you write about and Better Off. So obviously, you're making your peace in some ways with some technology.
Right. Well, I'm glad that the caller raised these questions because this is helpful to clear up what might seem to be a contradiction, and I can see how that it might seem to be a contradiction to have a website if I am trying to tell people not to use the computer. And the way I answer that question is by saying when you're trying to reach people in technological society, you go where they're at. You have to reach them oftentimes through technology. Even right now, I'm using a telephone and a radio system to reach these people. It wouldn't make sense for me to try to go to the Fiji Islands to reach these people. Or if I limited myself only to face-to-face communication and horse and buggy travel, then my only audiences would be those who already agree with me or already live this way of life, but I want to reach people who are actually in the technological society. So I do have a website, but I myself don't use a computer that much. And I think one of the best uses of technology is to help wean people away from technology. I don't think technology is bad in itself. And if in small doses it can actually help people get away from the larger part of technology, then technology is providing a useful service. And I never did fault technology as being evil in itself. And then as far as the second point that the caller made about sedentary lifestyle not necessarily being bad in itself because we can get so much more information. Well, I agree that it can be useful to use a computer to look up information over the World Wide Web and get it instantaneously, I suppose. But we have to recognize that we as human beings are more than disembodied brains or information receptacles. There's more to our life than this. And if we engage in a technological lifestyle as if we were nothing more than a floating set of neurons that can house information, then we are going to do a disservice, a grave disservice to the rest of ourselves, our whole being, which is a physical being, it's a social being. And one reason why I prefer to go to a library and look up a book is that it gives me an excuse, get on my bicycle, get some exercise, go through the neighborhood, maybe wave to some people I know, or bump into somebody who's walking a dog and strike up a conversation, breathe the fresh air, get to the library, walk up the steps, actually feel the book on the shelf. And here I am gratifying not just my brain, but my whole physical being and the social parts of myself and the part of myself that has an aesthetic appreciation of the outside and of the architecture in my neighborhood. And so every part of me is getting a little gratification when I do it that way.
You, an earlier caller asked about what was the, for people in these kind of old order groups, what was their motivation, what was their philosophical basis, and it suggested that somehow that these choices did at least have some kind of connection to people's religious values. You've also talked about the fact that you are Catholic. Do you think that there is some connection between your religious values and this way that you've chosen to live?
I think there's going to be a natural affinity between any kind of religion and living a way of life that's more technologically simple. And the reason is that if you have a religion, that means you recognize that there's some greater power or principle beyond yourself and that you are not all there is to the universe. And if you have that attitude, you're going to be much more likely to respect, say, nature and the way nature works and the way maybe social dynamics work around you, how people come together and social ties are formed. And as a result, you're going to need less or have less of a desire to use technology, because technology tends to give more power to the self and make the self self-contained or self-sufficient. And in fact, a lot of the reason why people use technology is precisely for that reason. They don't want to be dependent on other people. They don't want to have to answer to other people. They don't want to have to share things with other people. In the Amish and Mennonite communities, the opposite is true. Because they don't use technology, they have to rely on one another to help each other. And also, it means there is less separating themselves from the real world around them, including the natural world. And so they are subject to something greater that goes beyond themselves. So that's, I think, the connection. And as for being specifically Catholic, many people may not realize that if they don't know that much about the Catholic Church, it might seem like a big faceless example of organized religion. But there are actually deep strands in Catholicism that go way back, as far back as St. Francis, who talked about, brother, son, and sister, moon. I might have gotten those transposed. But even up to this century, there are very famous Catholic writers and thinkers, such as G.K. Chesterton, Hilaire Belloc, Thomas Merton, Dorothy Day, and a number one. Oh, even E.F. Schumacher, who wrote Small is Beautiful, was Catholic. So there's a lot in the Catholic heritage that is supportive of this way of life specifically, not just the Anabaptist heritage. And that's why I don't feel so bad remaining a Catholic, even amongst those who are somewhat anti-Catholic, because I think the Catholicism that they are responding to is from about 500 years ago, if that helps answer the question.
Yes. Well, we have about 15 minutes left. Again, let me introduce again our guest, Eric Brendy. We're talking about the story of a time that he and his wife spent living in a community, an old order Anabaptist group, after he, for thinking about this for a long time, decided he wanted to try living in a way that really simplified life, at least in terms of what kind of technology he used and how he lived. And he and his wife went to this community, and the story is told in the book Better Off: Flipping the Switch on Technology. That's the subtitle. It's published in paperback by Harper Perennial. If you'd like to read the book, certainly should be able to find it in the bookstore. Questions are welcome. We do have several people now lined up and ready to go, and we will start here with Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. I agree that a website is perfectly fine, and I don't see any problem with using technology if you use it intelligently. I don't really go along with the kind of Luddite approach to just getting rid of technology altogether. And then on the other end, people have talked about having computer voting, which some people actually think is more reliable, but it's really not. So I think the finding it just an intelligent compromise is better than either of the extremes. And other examples of technology not really working, there's been a this theory of labor-saving devices, which, as I think the guest pointed out, ignores just basic human physiology, that we all need exercise, we need labor, and there's lots of examples of commercial products, high-tech products that either don't work or break down or otherwise just don't do don't make life better the way they're thought to, and so there are lots of low technology approaches to life that can make your life better. There are lots of low technology ways of doing things that have actually been forgotten that are actually better than the way things are being done today.
Hmm. Well, Eric, you want to comment on some of what the caller had to say?
Yeah, I'm glad he pointed out the often fruitlessness of so-called labor-saving devices. And I think the type of technology that I'm addressing in my book mostly is the motorized automatic machine. I'm not so much addressing chemical technology, for example, or hand tool technology, but really this self-powered kind of machine that's supposed to save us labor. And of course, the big fallacy is that if we need exercise to be healthy, what good does it do us to remove the physical resistance from all of our daily activities, only to have to try to restore it again later and do the self-conscious exercise regimen, which we, you know, if you look out the window right now, you probably see somebody jogging by, but that same person probably drives to work. So there we go, get on the treadmill. And yes, and I think that particular type of technology, and if we are much more mindful of our choices in this regard, that alone is a huge, huge step. I think today we just take it for granted. Oh, it's a labor-saving device. It must save me labor. No, it may not. And you have to go through the additional step of reflecting and saying, well, will this or will this not save me labor? Will this or will this not improve my social ties to other people? And that consciousness in itself, I think, is halfway towards the solution.
Well, again, I'll thank the caller. Let's go and talk with someone in Kankakee. This is line number 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
To the guest, have you become a part of, or are you intending to become a part of a Catholic community which makes intentional choices with reference to technology? And if so, please discuss it. Thank you.
Am I trying to become part of one?
Yes.
Interestingly enough, there's a couple paragraphs in the book about how I tried to do just that. I just mentioned it very briefly, and it was a royal flop for a number of reasons that would probably be too complicated to go into. But now that I'm a little older and wiser, I can see that where I went wrong, or what some of the premises I had in mind were maybe a little faulty in trying to venture that. It was a very short-lived attempt. And so right now I am not trying to do that. I think that in order to do something like that, you really have to have a community like the Amish, which is fairly strictly regulated and has a long tradition going way back. And it's very hard to start something like that from scratch. And I'm not sure what the benefits are in this day and age. So right now, although I have friends, both Catholic and non-Catholic, in St. Louis who share our interests and values, we all just leave the individual choices to each separate family and don't try to get together. But we have on making those choices. And maybe someday down the line when there are more people who have this mindset, that maybe these things will spontaneously coalesce. Having said that, I do know of a couple of different options that are available for people interested in more of an organized community life with less technology. One stands out in my mind in particular. It's called, has anyone heard of the neo-traditional urban planning movement, or sometimes called the New Urbanism?
Mm-hmm.
It's an architectural movement that was begun by an architect from Cuba, but now living in Florida, named Andres Duany.
He's been on the show.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Well, he designed the community in Seaside, Florida, and all over the country, even one in St. Louis. And each one of his communities looks like a 19th century small town. And the guiding principle is to set up this this little community, this little reproduction of a small town, on a pedestrian scale, so people can walk or bicycle to all the different places they need to go, and they don't have to get into a car. And they also, all the houses have big, wide front porches as a way to encourage social interaction in the neighborhood. And it's all really a throwback to the 19th century town. But they're very well set up, very organized, very beautiful, and very expensive, which is one reason why I don't live in one. But if given the choice, if you had the choice between living in a community like that or a typical subdivision, you'd probably be much better off living in one of these planned 19th century replica towns.
You know, one of the people that we have not talked about at all and have hardly acknowledged about was that your wife was on this deal with you, and that you and she moved to this community when you had been married, I think, a little more than a week. How did she react to the initial idea of going, and then how did she like living there?
Well, when she heard that I was interested in the Amish, that's how she overheard me talking about it when I was at a dance in Boston. And she came up to me and said she always wanted to live on a farm. And I'd never met this person before. And I thought, wow, I've struck it rich here. And we got to know each other very well. But as the details became clearer that we would be living without electricity and indoor plumbing and all that, then she started to draw back and wonder if it was all a big mistake. And the only way I was able in the end to persuade her to join me for this year and a half experiment was to promise to give her the deciding vote on where we would live after the experiment was over. Ironically, after the year and a half, she was even more in love with the community than I was, and was less interested in leaving than I was. So, and I don't want to give away the plot of the book, exactly why we ended up leaving, and I'll leave that to the viewer's imagination or the listener's imagination.
Well, let's try. I want to make sure that I think we have one more caller in here. I want to try to get them in, and I want to thank all the previous callers, too. This is Champaign County and line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. There's so many overlapping things here, but I was going to joke and say whether you can take me from West End to Soulard on your rickshaw, but maybe another time. There's a point that was talked about at the beginning, the way of talking about it, pulling the plug versus getting off the grid. And there are a lot of appropriate technology people that just think the grid is, outmoded. We need to go to decentralized, and we have a revulsion for the kind of technology that exists, as opposed to some kind of revulsion at the whole process. And it seems to me that the religious dimension comes in with the sort of being in the world and not of the world, and this kind of self-abnegation kind of stance that a lot of religions, not just Christianity, have, that I think is actually a problem in another way. We still haven't heard about the Amish guy with the Rolex, though, either, so I guess that's a dimension that may not have time to explore. But if you could comment on the two stances,
Can you clarify that again?
Well, the idea that there are a lot of people that are off the grid, Summertown Farm in Tennessee, there's a lot of people up in the woods, places where they have windmill and waterfalls of their own, and they generate their own electricity, are off the grid. They're using technology at an appropriate level. They're not revolting against it in a more general way, and there's a religious dimension, the contemplative life, that's very isolating too. Now you can say, well, it's justified, but the idea that technology is isolating in and of itself is I agree with obviously the automobile is a nightmare because it does isolate people so much. But it doesn't mean that one doesn't use that one occasionally and use bicycles and mass transit when they're more appropriate, which is clearly most of the time, but not in the current culture. Is that any clearer?
Everything you said sounded good, and I could comment, go in several different directions there. But one thing I would say, if this helps clarify anything, is what I'm aiming toward in writing this book is not to make people think that they need to move out of a city and out onto the farm somewhere or live totally off the grid, as we did during the book. The only reason that we were living so primitively in the book was so that we could conduct this, as I call it, a personal, hands-on experiment, living with less technology to see if, in fact, life might be easier or better with less. But as for the practical consequences for individuals of what kind of technology they choose to use, you can do it either in the city, on the grid, or in the country, off the grid. Anywhere you live, you can make intelligent technological choices. And I do think the gentleman is right that top of the list is the automobile. I'd say the big three, time and money and labor wasters, the automobile, the computer, and the television. And to the extent that no matter where you live, you can reduce or eliminate your dependence on these kinds of technologies and find healthier substitutes, real-life interaction with people, you know, walking or bicycling around the neighborhood to and from work, to that extent, you'll be better off.
We are pretty much at the point here where we're going to have to finish. Any last sort of thought that you'd like to leave with people who are listening?
Well, I would say that whatever you do, take it slow. There is no need to rush, and be willing to try out different things and test your results and see what works and what doesn't. The last thing I want somebody to do is to go cold turkey all of a sudden, and then when they find that it doesn't work and it backfires, then say, "Oh, I tried that, it didn't work. Now I'm going to go back to the way I used to live." No, it's a much more a gradual kind of a process that a person has to go through, and it involves kind of some reflection and meditation. And so that's the thought I would leave people with, not to rush into it, but to reflect about it and take their time.
If you would like to read this story that we have been talking about, look for the book Better Off, Flipping the Switch on Technology by our guest Eric Brindy. It's published by Harper Perennial. And if you're thinking about visiting St. Louis, or you know you're going to be in St. Louis and you might like a little tour, you can look for his website, which is St. Louis Rickshaw, and find out about this rickshaw taxi service that he has there in St. Louis. And Mr. Brindy, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, David. And one last little point. At the end of the paperback book, there is a whole selection of practical tips about how to live with less technology.
Very good. So people can check that out. Well, the broadcast today here on Focus 580 is made possible in part by Eastern Rug Gallery, offering a wide selection of guaranteed hand-knotted Oriental and Persian rugs of every size and color combination, from new to antique, to complement any decor. Eastern Rug Gallery is at 1402 South Neal Street in Champaign. The broadcast is also made possible by a grant from the Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff there at the Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. That's it for us on Focus. We want you to stay tuned, though. Much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll broadcast an interview from the archives when we'll look back at the 1965 murder of a civil rights worker following the Alabama Voting Rights March. Turning our attention now to the Chicago Board of Trade, September wheat trading.